The Jeffrey McDonald case is one of the most horrifying and controversial murder cases of its time. With chilling echoes of the Manson family's helter-skelter killings, a handsome, Ivy League-educated Green Beret Army doctor accused of brutally stabbing and clubbing to death his pregnant wife and two young daughters in the middle of the night, McDonald was eventually convicted and is serving three consecutive life sentences. Perhaps no one is better qualified to address the questions than Joe McGinnis, who was first drawn into the story in 1979 when he began work on what became the definitive account of the case, Fatal Vision. 43 years after the murders, the debate around that verdict lives on. McDonald, now a gray-haired 68-year-old, continues to attract supporters, most recently acclaimed filmmaker Errol Morris, whose recent book cast doubt not only on the conviction, but of Joe McGinnis's account. The ruling on McDonald's latest motion for a new trial is due in early 2013, but as McGinnis makes clear in his new ebook, Final Vision, The Last Word on Jeffrey McDonald, his guilt is undeniable, he believes. Joe McGinnis is the author of 12 books, including The Selling of the President, about the marketing of Richard Nixon during the 1968 campaign, and a best-selling trilogy of true crime books, Fatal Vision, Blind Faith, and Cruel Doubt. It is a great pleasure to welcome Joe McGinnis back to the roundtable. Sir, thank you very much for taking the time out. I appreciate it, as always.
Hey, good morning, Joe, and Happy New Year.
A Happy New Year to you. Very nice to have you on the program. You know, the thing about, we had Errol Morris on the show when the book came out. And then... I was, of course, interested, as I think many people were interested, in how of what you thought about it. And what I thought was interesting about your response, the immediate response, and of course this book that we're going to talk about is a much more thoughtful and has a bit more perspective. But the immediate response was one you just seemed somewhat beleaguered that 43 years later we were still debating this.
Well, it's kind of it's the longest running criminal case in the history of the U.S. justice system, and a lot of people wonder why. How could it be that 43 years later this case is still not closed? There was an evidentiary hearing on McDonald's latest motion for a new trial in September in Wilmington, North Carolina. I was subpoenaed by the Justice Department, and I had to go down there and testify. And it was a remarkable thing, Joe, to look around the room and spend a week down there and see these veterans of this case, these people I had first met back in the 1970s, the ones who were still surviving, shuffling around, you know, not quite with their walkers and oxygen tanks, but getting close. And the thing is that is still not over, and there's actually nothing. There's nothing left really to debate, and there hasn't been for years. Our system, which is a system that I would defend staunchly, allows convicted criminals to appeal even beyond their initial appeal under the habeas corpus doctrine, saying that they've discovered something new that constitutes a constitutional violation, and that if the jury in the original trial had known about this, the verdict would have been different. And as long as you can get a lawyer to file these motions for you, and with the McDonald case, there's always been publicity, so lawyers have not been hard to come by, you can keep going back to court. I asked Brian Murtaugh, Justice Department prosecutor, who's been involved in this case since even long before the 1979 trial, how much this has cost the American taxpayers up until now. And he couldn't really come up with a viable estimate, but it's somewhere beyond $5 million that has been spent by the government simply keeping McDonald in jail where a jury sent him in 1979. And to me, the amazing thing is how quickly the media wants to jump on something and says, oh, wow, dramatic new discoveries. Oh, wow, new evidence. There's no new evidence. There hasn't been any new evidence ever. The so-called new DNA evidence, That the results of that DNA testing were made public in 2006, and it proves nothing. The media loves a news story, a hot story, a conspiracy theory, and Errol Morris played into that. And if it had only been Errol Morris, I would never have written Final Vision. But having been down there testifying and being asked so often, how can this still be going on? What I have done here with Final Vision is to write basically a full legal history of the case. What happened with the McDonald case after Fatal Vision was published in 1983?
One of the things that I found fascinating about the book and reading it is how you remind us as readers that while the crime occurred in 1970, right? It was 1970.
Yes.
Crime occurred in 1970. He was not convicted until 9 years later. He was not. That trial did not take place until 9 years later, until 1979. And the thing you point out is part of why that took 9 years is because of the difference between a military court and a civilian court, which is really fascinating because when we think of this as a four-decade-plus odyssey, 10 years of that was taken up within the military system, really.
Well, actually, Joe, I don't think it was. When he was serving in the Army on active duty when he committed the murders, and he went through what's the equivalent of a preliminary hearing. The military held an Article 32 hearing. That's to determine whether the evidence is sufficient to warrant a court-martial. For reasons that I explain in some detail in Final Vision, the Army simply didn't want McDonald around. They were getting hammered with bad publicity. My Lai, Kent State.
This was Vietnam.
The Vietnam War was going to hell.
Right.
Everything was. And the last thing they needed was a Green Beret doctor court-martialed, the media circus that would be, for murdering his own wife and two little girls on an Army base. They said, let's get rid of this guy and leave it to the Justice Department and the FBI. They can go after him if they want to. And that's what happened. He was discharged from the Army in October of 1970.
Honorably.
Honorably, that's right. Honorably, there was no reason not to give him an honorable discharge. And then the Army continued to investigate. The Article 32 did not close the door. The Army spent two more years investigating, turned over a huge file to the Justice Department and the FBI. They continued to investigate. And finally, in 1975, they had enough evidence to call a grand jury together, and the grand jury indicted McDonald. The next 4 years of delay were because of McDonald's lawyers filing appeals on two grounds. One, double jeopardy. They said he'd already been tried by the military, so to try him as a civilian would constitute double jeopardy. The ruling there was that it did not, because the Article 32 hearing was not the equivalent of a jury trial. A court-martial would have been, but the Article 32 was not. Secondly, the denial of his right to a speedy trial. The Justice Department took 2.5 years. They considered what to do with this case. They analyzed, and they kicked it around for 2.5 years before deciding to convene the grand jury. He argued that deprived him of his right to a speedy trial. An appellate court agreed with him, and the charges were ordered to be dismissed, and then the government appealed that to the United States Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, no, he has not been denied his right to a speedy trial. Chief Justice Berger wrote an opinion, joined by six other Supreme Court justices. And that's what set the trial up for 1979. You know, it seemed then like the case had gone on forever. 9 years after the murders, the man finally goes to trial. But just look at the time that's elapsed since. What is it now? 33, 34 years since. And we're still talking about this. It's a phenomenal story. I never thought I would still be involved. But when I saw the media's gullibility and be willing to swallow or drink the Errol Morris Kool-Aid to the extent that they did, I said, you know, I just wouldn't feel right here toward the end of my career, not setting the record straight, not getting something out there so people can see what the truth about this is, and that's why I wrote Final Vision.
There are a couple of things that I want to get to, because this is so huge and there's so many different aspects and so many different ways we could go. But one of the things that I'm just curious about, just because I find this fascinating. I mean, you write in the book about how you came to this case, the deal that was forged between the two of you, between you and McDonald, in writing Fatal Vision, of how you would work together. Because I mean, you would live together. You would go out and runs and stuff while you were working on this. And some will say that, well, then you were in his camp, and then when the book came out, it was against McDonald, and then he sued you and all of that. I'm curious as to what it was like 3+ decades later to be in that courtroom this past September and seeing that man for the first time in many, many, many years.
Well, yes, it was the first time since 1987. And I can tell you, he didn't look good. Prison is not a good place to grow old. And McDonald has certainly grown old. You know, we all have. I'm 70. Murtaugh is 67. Everybody involved in this case is 33 years older than they were at the time of the trial. But McDonald looked terrible. He was shrunken, stooped, not just gray-haired, but gray tone on his skin. He had ankle shackles on, of course. He was he had to wear inmates' coveralls. He sat at his table next to his lawyers, and the 2 days that I was on the witness stand, I testified starting on a Friday morning, and then I was called back for further testimony the next Monday. And all the time that I sat up there, I would continually look over at him just to see if he would ever once look me in the eye, and he would not. He never raised his eyes from that table. He would not even look me in the eye. And I got a chance to tell some truth that it had actually not come out before. My testimony turned out to be useful because I was the one person not working for McDonald who was in the room when his lawyer tried to get the so-called girl in the floppy hat to confess to having been there. She was brought into Raleigh to testify 9 years after the murders. She had sometimes said, oh, yeah, I think I might have been there. Sometimes she said, no, I wasn't. She was a hopeless mess of a drug addict. And she, in fact, had no connection with the case and was simply trying to gain attention by her repeated comments that she thought she might have been there. She wasn't sure. I was in the room for 3 hours when McDonald's lawyer tried to get her to say she was there. She would not. She said, right now, we're at the crux of this. No, I was not there. I can say nothing that would help you. McDonald's lawyer goes into court and tells the federal judge that, in fact, she had confessed to him. He told that he committed perjury. He lied. Well, he wasn't perjury. He was a lawyer. But he lied to a federal judge in the middle of a triple homicide trial. I hadn't even realized that myself until I saw transcripts of the bench conferences for the first time this past fall. So, even all these years later, even I can still learn new things about the case. But anything new that I learn, anything new that anybody learns, to tell you the truth, only points in the same direction. McDonald did it. It's frankly an open and should be shut case. And for all the drama and romance and the admiration for Errol Morris for earlier work that he did, and apparently he's done some very fine filmmaking, he's way, way off base here. And not only I, but Gene Weingarten of the Washington Post wrote a 6,000-word story in the Post magazine. You can get it online. It ran in December. And that points out in great detail all the flaws and fallacies in Errol Morris's argument.
Yeah, he really excoriated the process that Morris used in his reporting, making the case that Errol Morris is not a reporter; he is a filmmaker. One of the things that I find fascinating about this whole story and what has developed over the last 6 months or so with the book A Wilderness of Error, which is Errol Morris's account. You make several points in Final Vision, the book we're talking about, the new ebook, that A, Your view of Jeffrey McDonald has not changed since you wrote Fatal Vision, which I think is a key point. You feel now the way you felt then about him and about his guilt. And the other thing is that you so often point out about how involved you were in the trial, the original trial in 1979, how you were there for every moment of that trial, where Errol Morris, you point out, really came to this story very, very late.
He came late, and he came really under the auspices and with the encouragement of a Boston attorney named Harvey Silverglate, who for 20 years worked as an appellate lawyer for McDonald. And Harvey Silverglate and Errol Morris are old friends in the Cambridge and Boston area. And Harvey was feeding Errol Morris his views of the case, and Morris started from that perspective. His book is not an investigation, it's really a polemic. It argues very strongly that McDonald did not receive a fair trial. I was at the trial, and in Fatal Vision, I pull no punches. I write that I think the judge was predisposed to not like McDonald's lawyer. I think the judge did not give McDonald any breaks. But on the other hand, the trial was fair under our standards of fairness. The judge did not commit any reversible error. The jury made up its mind based on the facts presented in court, and the rules of evidence were applied. They were applied fairly and across the board. So to come along 30 years later and say McDonald was railroaded, and this was a sort of kangaroo court, a bunch of southern rednecks got together and decided they were going to punish this guy, that's just nonsense. That jury was not composed of a bunch of tobacco farmers.
Oh, no.
11 of the 12 members of that jury had at least some college education. I talked to more than half of them after the verdict, and they were a sensitive and intelligent group, and they paid very careful attention to the evidence, and they were very unhappy with where it led them. They didn't want to find McDonald guilty. They didn't want to have to make this decision, but they were faced with the reality of his guilt. They really had no choice, and so they came back, and they did it. Errol Morris, for example, says in his book that the jury was sequestered during the trial. Well, that's simply wrong. The jury was not sequestered. They came and went every day to and from their homes. Mm. There's many mistakes that Morris makes simply because he wasn't there. And a lot of the people who are commenting on Morris's book and accept what he says at face value, they don't know because they haven't even read Fatal Vision. They don't know the facts of the case. They see somebody comes along and cries injustice, and he's a guy with a pretty good track record, and they say, oh, boy, here's a bandwagon we can jump on. But that bandwagon's just going right off a cliff.
One of the things that I think I'm curious about, because it's when you look at, obviously, Jeffrey McDonald is a man who was on trial and maybe again.
Actually, he won't be again, Joe.
well, I mean, they're hearing, right? You went for the hearing, correct?
Yes, the judge's hearing, the judge who conducted the evidentiary hearing, ruled in 2008 that none of McDonald's claims had any merit. For various technical reasons, which I go into in Final Vision, but I won't try to explain because we don't have the time here, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals felt that he didn't jump through all the hoops quite the way he should have. And so they sent it back. So this hearing was basically to allow him, the judge, to jump through all the hoops the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals wanted. He's going to reach the same decision. There's nothing that came out of the hearing that's going to change his mind. So sometime, probably in late spring, early summer, he will once again deny McDonald's motion for a new trial.
But it was a motion for a new trial, and if he does, then there would be another trial.
It is theoretically possible.
Okay.
But if I were a betting man, there's no odds that I would take.
Right.
That.
Well, I don't disagree with you. I just but that is the possibility, and that is what was being handled at the hearing that you talked about. But one of the real quick, because we're running out of time. Let us just talk momentarily about the evidence at hand here. You mentioned the girl in the floppy hat. One of the key things here was the woman by the name of Helen Stokely, who has passed. She died in 1983. Of her story, and it is, as you say, obviously a very troubled woman. And so how does this again become part of the story where we find out more about her, especially after her death?
Well, she was investigated, and I make this point in Final Vision. It's one of the key points. Errol Marr says that people simply never looked at her as a suspect. That's nonsense. That's absolutely off the wall. I don't think there's ever been a figure involved in a major murder case in this country who was investigated more thoroughly over a longer period of time by more people than Helena Stokely. And conclusively, every time somebody looked at the essence of her story, every time, everybody who did came to the same conclusion: this poor girl is just making stuff up to get attention. She had nothing to do with this. The evidence that convicted McDonald was the physical evidence, the patterns of blood in the house, the location of hairs and fibers, the weapons. It's the totality of this evidence. It's not something you can pick out one or two things. But over the course of 9 weeks, 7 weeks of the trial, the jury heard all the physical evidence, and that's undeniable. As the prosecutor, James Blackburn, said, people can and do lie, but things do not lie. And I think that's the bottom line to the whole case. It's the things that don't lie that prove McDonald's guilt. And it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what Errol Morris thinks. It only matters now what Judge Fox thinks and what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals is going to think. And I'm pretty confident in being able to predict how they're going to rule.
And ultimately, that justice was served. And in this case, you believe that was the case, the justice
was
served.
Yes, our system, if our system discriminates against defendants, and I think in some cases it probably does, it's not Ivy League educated doctors of medicine who are serving as officers in the Green Berets. Jeffrey McDonald is the kind of person our system discriminates in favor of, not against. And he's gotten more time in court, more fair hearings than probably he deserves.
Is there any regret that you have in covering the case?
No, I'm just glad that I was able to get involved early, to learn as much as I did, and to be able, still all this time later, to be able to make sure that the truth gets out.
The name of the book is Final Vision, The Last Word on Jeffrey McDonald.
It is. By the way, Joe, you don't need a Kindle or a Nook to read it. You can download this right to your computer.
Yeah, if you go to byliner.com, you can find out how to figure it all out. Although, if you do have one of those devices, it's easy enough to download right there as well. And it's a short and very in-depth read. Final Vision, The Last Word on Jeffrey McDonald. Joe McGinnis, again, always great to talk to you. Happy New Year to you, sir.
Likewise. Thanks again, Joe. My pleasure.
Thank you. Great pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.